Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and I'm really pleased to introduce you to our first guest today. She says that every life is a food story, and every food story is unique. Talking to Laura Shapiro, she's the author of the new book. It's called What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. She is the author of three classic books of culinary history, including Julia Child, A Life. And she's written stories for the New York Times, The New Yorker, Gourmet, and many other publications. What do you think? Do you think food can tell you about a person? I hope you'll join in our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Show us a photo that tells us something about you. That'd be kind of fun. And Laura Shapiro, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know, I wasn't sure I was going to like your book. I'll be really honest, right from the start. I told my producer, okay. But I tell you what, you have written a fascinating book about six remarkable, in their own ways, women. Thank you so much for writing it.
Well, you're welcome, but, you know, I'm interested. What made you think you wouldn't like it?
I don't know. I wondered if food and people, how do you tell anything about people by what they eat? I eat a whole variety of things, and maybe that tells something about me. I don't know.
I can see you're not one of these people that stares over at the other plate on the table and watches the other person while they're eating and defines their whole life from that, which is something I do.
Oh, see, when I go to a Chinese restaurant, for example, you know how often it is people want to share, you know, is the five or six or however many dishes. I'm the one who wants to just eat what I ordered.
All right. Now, you've just revealed something very important and interesting about yourself. I think that's incredibly useful to know.
Well, six remarkable women, and let's see, who are all the women? We've got Eva Braun. We've got, I'm trying to remember all the names here. We've got Barbara.
Well, I start with
Dorothy Wordsworth.
Right, the sister of the poet. And then we have Rosa Lewis, who was an Edwardian-era caterer. Then there's Eleanor Roosevelt, whom, of course, you know. Eva Braun, who was Hitler's mistress. A wonderful British novelist named Barbara Pym, who published in the 50s and 60s. And then Helen Gurley Brown, the longtime editor of Cosmopolitan.
I thought that was there were some fascinating selections, and I knew nothing about most of these women, to be perfectly honest, and you've revealed so much, and I found myself, and I was talking to my producer, Jill Nadone, who says, I want to follow up on some more books about some of the people that you wrote about.
Oh, good. You'll see many, many more things. Most of these people do have quite a bit written about them. My hope in looking at their lives this way was that if I started asking questions about food, I would get to ideas and answers and aspects of their lives that had not come through in the other biographies. So that was really what motivated me to start looking at these people.
Why do you think food helps reveal who we are?
Well, because it's just part of everything. Food is our first preoccupation. The first thing that appeals to us on this earth is food, and it's one of the last preoccupations before we die. It's consistent throughout our life. We all eat, even people who don't cook, even people who get up from the table and they have totally forgotten about the meal the minute they push the chair back. They all have a relationship with food. It reflects our place in society, class, culture, gender, socioeconomic profile. Everything that is around us and in us, I think, is reflected in the food that we eat. So I'm telling you, I think when you look at that plate, you see a whole world that is that person.
Well, you certainly brought that to life in your stories about these, your writings about these women, for sure. Were there some who didn't make the cut? I imagine there were some women who didn't make the cut.
Actually, there were. There were a couple of women that I couldn't pursue simply because I couldn't get the information. One of the things that's actually hardest to find out about people is what they ate and what their attitudes towards food is, unless they happen to be a culinary professional and they're a chef or they're Julia Child or something. But other than that, even people who write diaries that, you know, 100 years later, we're all reading their diary, or they left letters and their grandchildren save the letters, they very often don't say a word about what they ate. So you have to, for a book like this, find people who did leave like a breadcrumb trail through the documents that you could find out the food. So there were some people that I had to not pursue because of that. And there are, you know, it's a book about women and food, and a lot of women, their relationship with food is about dieting. And I couldn't have a book full of dieters. I have a couple of dieters, but I didn't want to, you know, push it so heavily into that territory. So it was, you know, considerations like that.
You know, each of the women you talk about were successful in their own way, but there was a lot of, I think, disappointment and sadness in their lives.
Well, yes. Absolutely. And, you know, that's what, from a biographer's point of view, that's what makes for an interesting life. You see people not only in the glory of their success and their happiness, but you see them in every kind of emotional tangle. And the food so often tells you so much about that. Eleanor Roosevelt is a great example because she really, her food story takes place inside the White House, where it's all related to her marriage, and it takes place outside the White House, where it's all related to her own life and her friends and her kind of independent political life that she carried on after FDR died. Those are different food stories. It was different food. She related to it in different ways. So you see the, you know, this huge tangle of problems that had to do with her marriage on the one side, and then this kind of her flush of freedom and self-expression that she experienced afterwards. It's all in the food, I'm telling you.
Well, just to stay on Eleanor Roosevelt for a bit, apparently the food served at the White House under FDR's reign was considered the worst of pretty much any president.
It really was, and it was recognized as that even at the time. It's not like the press was very polite about it. They all wrote about how bad the food was. It was criticized all the time, and, you know, it's astonishing. People would go to the White House because they were very hospitable. They invited all kinds of people to meals, and then, you know, you're having dinner at the White House, so when you get home, you immediately write to everybody you know and tell them you just ate at the White House. And they all said the same thing. FDR was, you know, so charming and interesting, and Eleanor made them feel so welcome and at ease. Then they're just slack-jawed with amazement at how bad the food was, and they all write the same thing. They can't believe it. They'll say, we were served these slabs of cold gray mutton. Well, I know from looking at the menus from that day, it wasn't mutton. It was lamb that had been overcooked so badly that they all thought it was mutton. The soggy vegetables, they all talk about that. These ridiculous salads with the marshmallows in it, they all talk about that. So we have a very clear record of how terrible that food was.
Yeah, and Eleanor Roosevelt said she didn't care about what she ate, but she did care, did she not?
Yeah. It was a complicated picture. What she wanted was for the White House food to reflect her own political values. And, you know, she was a great progressive reformer, And of course, this administration was during the Depression, and then it was the war and rationing. She was very eager for the White House to kind of demonstrate that you could serve a family economically and very simply, spend little on food, but have it be very nourishing. That's what she wanted to show the world about White House food. She did not want to project an image of everybody kind of rolling around in some luxury of truffles and champagne, and sure enough, she didn't. So she wanted very simple food. Well, you know, if anybody who cooks knows, you can make very simple economical food and have it be delicious. It just has to be well-chosen ingredients and good cooking, and that was just what they didn't have. She had hired a housekeeper who knew nothing about food and nothing about cooking, really, and so what actually turned up on the table, despite her good intentions, was not only simple, it was inedible. and she could have changed it. She could have fired that housekeeper. But that's where the kind of issues of her marriage creep in. FDR had a penchant for, you know, blondes, and he had a great taste for luxury living himself. He had been brought up with excellent food. He was the first foodie president. But she did not want to feed that side of him. She didn't go along with his delight in the cocktail hour and the surrounding himself with these adoring friends. That was not her thing. So she, you know, is it conscious? Is it not conscious? Who knows? But she was perfectly content to put food in front of him that he really couldn't eat.
And he hated it, but he never, I don't know if he ever asked her to fire the person in charge.
Well, they had a kind of uneasy balance there. He complained a lot, but he didn't ask her. He knew that he was kind of the guilty party in their marriage. He had had this affair many years earlier. That had really destroyed the marriage in a lot of ways, and he got it. He understood what was going on there. He dealt with the food that came to him, although, actually, after his mother died, his mother lived in this big house in Hyde Park and had a wonderful kitchen and great cooks. After she died, he hired one of those cooks, brought her to the White House, had a little kitchen built near his study, and that cook made meals that he could eat. So from that point on, you start seeing two sets of menus. Everybody else is getting creamed chipped beef on toast, and the president is getting something little, he'll get a nice omelet or something that's a little better made than that.
Well, omelets remind me of their Sunday night ritual when she actually was the person cooking.
Yes, this was a wonderful scene. They had done this from early in their marriage. They would invite friends and family, and they would bring out a chafing dish, which was very popular in the 19th and early 20th century. And you, in a chafing dish, you kind of sit there and do this cooking in full view of the company. So Eleanor, who really was not much of a cook and didn't try to be, she would have the servant bring out the eggs and the cream and the salt and the pepper, and she would make these scrambled eggs in the chafing dish, and it was like a performance. She was kind of showing what it would be like to be a wife and mother in that situation. Only she kind of knew it was a performance, but they both loved the performance. They both enjoyed those meals. Those were probably the happiest meals that they had as a family, both before the White House and in the White House, where she would scramble the eggs and they were surrounded by close friends. I think those were happy times over food.
I think so as well. It was pretty much every Sunday night. We're talking today with Laura Shapiro. She is the author of What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. I'm Larry Mailer. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45 today, Wisconsin author Michael Perry is with us to talk about his latest book, Danger Man Working. I hope you can stay with us for that. Right now, enjoying this conversation with Laura Shapiro, who is the author of What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the food that tells their stories. How do you think food tells a story about a person? What questions do you have about the women profiled in Laura's book? Eleanor Roosevelt, Helen Gurley Brown, Eva Braun, Barbara Pym, Dorothy Wordsworth, and Rosa Lewis. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. You think food is a good way to get to know someone? Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. I was, Laura, I was really interested, sort of a war buff in a way, and that I've read a lot of books about World War One and Two and the Civil War here. And so I was really interested to learn a little about Eva Braun, who was Hitler's mistress. She's always been a bit of a mystery to me, and I think to most people. How did you get to know her, and what did you think of her devotion to Hitler?
Well, that was really the question that drove me, exactly what you're saying. You know, who is this person? How can we possibly read that horrible relationship? And it was she's somebody that I chose to look at through food because I couldn't figure out any other way to try to answer those questions. I read a couple of very good, very substantive biographies of her, but they didn't seem to me to kind of zero in on this, on the kind of heart of the matter. She was a horrible person, no question about it. She wasn't an active Nazi. She certainly was a believer. She didn't join the party, and she was not a big player in the atrocities of that time, but she was what we would call today an enabler. Just by her feminine presence, she kind of created a kind of field force of goodwill around what was really very, very horrible. And when I looked at the food, what I saw almost more than anything else was surprising to me. It was the flow of champagne that ran through the Third Reich. You know, they were plundering it hand over fist from the French. The minute they occupied that country, they started stealing and drinking the champagne. And to the Nazis, to these, you know, German thugs and the lowlife and the people who were really part of that movement, this was the greatest thing they'd ever seen, free champagne. This is wonderful. Bring it on. So they were, they're like drinking this stuff all the time. And Eva Braun, who loved the image of herself as Hitler's consort. She was beautifully dressed, and she was. She changed clothes 6 or 7 times a day. She wanted to dress the part. She wanted to be known to the world as the woman who was sitting next to what she called the most powerful man on earth. Well, the world wasn't going to see that at the time. She was actually kept out of sight. They were not married, and Hitler didn't want the world to know that he was hanging out with a woman half his age. So she was never sort of seen in public. But at their meals together, to which his entourage was invited, there she could be in public in that small circle. And this was like the highlight of her life, to be at these meals. The champagne is being passed around the table, and she is the beautifully dressed consort. So my analysis of Eva Braun really came down to like a bubble. It's a metaphor, but it's real also. She lived in a bubble. All of the chaos, the destruction, the bloodshed of World War II going on around her, she was shielded from it. She chose a life that was completely secured off, and it was celebratory, and it was festive, and it had all kinds of light and delight in it through this, what was in fact a very fragile bubble that she chose to live in. She, as I say, a horrible person, but an extremely interesting way to look at something that was going on at that time.
I was really struck in the in your writing about the plundering of France. Was it a half or two-thirds of all of the livestock and so forth were carted out of France and back to Germany?
Yes, not just France, all the occupied countries. This was Hitler's plan as he was making the plans to basically take over Europe and Eastern Europe and Russia. It was a lot about food. What had happened, as you know from reading about World War One, the Germans in World War One had gotten very discouraged by being, they were hungry all the time. There were incredible food shortages in Germany during the conduct of that war. Hitler was determined that this would not happen again. His idea was, okay, the rest of the world will go hungry. We in Germany will not. So the minute they got into a country that they occupied, they started just carting the food out any way they could. By train, they put it in their pockets. They basically drained those countries dry, and they starved the inhabitants, if that's what it took, because they fed them enough to keep them as workers, maybe, but enslaved. But basically, the food that fed Germany during the war came from these occupied countries. It was very much a war about food. And as you know, our sort of enduring image of World War II is one of starvation, these images from concentration camps that we're all familiar with, and they are the true horrifying images of that war. But there was another food story going on in that war, and that is that the Nazis were living it up at their very, very well-filled tables, having a high old time. And that was the kind of food story I wanted to tell.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was also interesting to me that as they were sort of mobilizing for war, I don't know if you'd call it a marketing campaign or an information campaign within Germany itself was to promote local foods and not foods that came from somewhere else where they weren't going to be available when the war came around.
Yeah, exactly. It was that had to do with foreign exchange and how the economy, so much of the economy was tilted towards building up the war machine. They simply did not have money to bring in a lot of the imported foods that Germany had been relying on, even wheat and oranges and coffee, all these things that were coming in from other countries traditionally. They wanted to get people accustomed to giving up those things and eating kind of homegrown equivalents like this sort of fake coffee and imitation butter and all these things. So it was a wartime food schedule that they were promoting. But of course, among the Nazis, they had plenty of butter. They had white bread. They had sugar. They had all these things that the Germans had to ration. Around Hitler's circle, they were doing just fine in all those things. But what really happened in World War II was that because of the plundering and because of this policy of getting so much from the occupied countries, Germans didn't really suffer a lot of hunger until the last stages of the war. They were adequately fed on the whole throughout those years, which extended the time of the war exactly as Hitler had planned.
Yeah. And Eva Braun herself was always kind of worried. She liked food, I think, but she was always worried about her appearance. She wanted to stay thin, and so she didn't eat a lot, if I'm not mistaken.
No, she wasn't a fanatic dieter like Hillengerly Brown, the true dieter in this book, but she did. She watched what she ate. The typical kind of middle-class German diet was heavy, and she ate carefully within that diet. Her focus on her appearance was a very, very important part of her character. She was focused on everyone's appearance. She was focused on the surface of things. What do we look like? What do we dress like? What's the scene? She was a very enthusiastic amateur photographer and home video, or home movie maker. And there's quite a lot of her photography and her home movies. They were collected after the war. They survived, and you can look at them. And you see that she had this fixation on the surface of things. That, I think, is how she survived her own the awfulness of her own life, the way she was able to stay within this bubble was to look only at the surfaces. So she would take home movies of all of them, the Nazis and their wives, you know, socializing in Berchtesgaden and so forth, and they're just relaxed and having a wonderful time. That was her view of wartime life.
Very attractive woman. I really like the photo you have of her and Hitler in your book. She's very attractive.
Yes. Yeah, showing them at the table and attending to what they're eating. And she was nice looking. And why on earth a pretty young teenager committed herself to this older guy who was not particularly important at the time? He was a rising star in the Nazis, but he was not what he became. She didn't need this. Something else drew them together, and I still don't know what that could have been.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rosa Lewis is maybe the least well-known of the six women you profiled, but I thought she was a fascinating person. Tell us about her.
That is a great story. Some people may remember a PBS series that was on in the 1970s called The Duchess of Duke Street. That was based loosely on her life. She was born in 1867 in a working-class family. She had a strong Cockney accent. She was a scullery maid at the age of 12. But she climbed up the social ladder by learning to cook. The fancy cookery of that time was this very elaborate French cooking. She learned it, and she used it to raise herself to the highest level as a caterer to the great noble families of England of that time, including the royal family. And she made a lot of money. She bought the Cavendish Hotel. So in some ways, it's like an Eliza Doolittle, My Fair Lady story, except unlike Eliza Doolittle, whose goal in life, you know, was to get rid of this Cockney accent and become a lady in society, Rosa Lewis also wanted to be a lady in society, but she insisted on keeping her accent.
Yeah.
She wanted to be accepted for exactly who she was, and with all of her lowly beginnings still around her, even when she drifted into a drawing room wearing a Paris gown. Well, it doesn't quite work in England. You know, the British are very accent conscious. She almost made it, but she didn't quite. And that story is very, very clear in the kind of food that she cooked. She is a really interesting character.
Oh, these long, tedious meals that were the the end thing of the day. And she planned these meals, and she watched over every single detail. She'd even go and buy the quail or whatever herself, and make darn sure that every quail was perfect.
Yeah, she learned to cook from, we're not quite sure how, but some French chef obviously taught her to cook, because she shopped and cooked the way the French did. Huge attention to the ingredients and every detail of the ingredients. And so in that sense, she was very French. But she also, because she was a woman cook in a very patriarchal, anti-female culinary world, which is what London was in those days, she knew that the real French chefs of her time were looking down on her. So she always said the French were terrible and the British were better cooks, but she knew perfectly well where the good food was.
Well, he's talking about England. Barbara Pym, another name that a lot of people won't recognize. Were you a fan of her novels?
Yes, I had been reading her novels for years, and when I got the idea for this book, I thought, at last I can write about Barbara Pym. She's one of my favorites. She published a number of novels in Britain in the 1950s and 60s, and they are full of food. They're full of British food, which, as you know, it's supposed to be the worst in the world. Nobody sits around reminiscing happily about the food they were eating in England after World War II. But Barbara Pym, as a novelist, this is her method. She would go and sit in a coffee shop or Lyons Corner House, which were the cafeterias of that time. She'd have a little notebook. She would watch the people go through the cafeteria line and see what they put on the trays, and they would carry it to a table, and she would watch them, and then she would eavesdrop on what they were talking about as they ate. She put it all down in these notebooks, and that was the key to character. She'd see a very beautifully dressed woman taking ketchup and dumping it all over her eggs and French fries. That was a key to character. So when you see the food in those books, I think you can believe it, and because it came right from the life around her. And a lot of that food was delicious. A lot of it was the horrible, sludgy British food that we think of. Everything is covered with this fake custard or this boiled to death. It's all the stuff, all the cliches are there. But there's also wonderful food, beautiful, simple salads, and very delicate, lovely French things that they were making. And Italian, they're doing these long-simmered pasta sauces and things. My feeling is that when you look at those books, you have to rewrite the history of British cuisine in those years, because she is giving us a different picture about it.
She really upended a lot of stereotypes, I think, about British food.
She absolutely did, and she's doing it through this wonderful cast of characters, these hilarious novels. She has a wonderful satirical view. She's got these women that on the surface, they look like the most uninteresting women in the world. They're wearing the cardigans and the sensible shoes. They're going to the church jumble sales. They're pouring tea for the visiting clergy. You think, how can this be interesting? They are hilarious. They will skewer some fat-headed male in the room without the guy even noticing. They're just, she's a wonderfully funny writer, and if anything comes out of my book, I hope that more people discover Barbara Pym. She's a great writer.
I have not read any of her books, and I plan to take a look, because she sounds like a fascinating a person for sure. And her books, I mean, she had some success for, I think, about six books or so, and then she kind of fell out of favor and then was rediscovered.
Yes, it's a great story. She had good, healthy success, not huge, but she certainly had many readers for her first novels. And then, publishing is like this. Her publisher went on to do kind of more glamorous, flashier, sexier books. She couldn't get published anymore. For 14 years, she got nothing but rejection letters. She was a real writer. She just kept writing. Finally, 14 years later, the Times Literary Supplement asked a number of kind of eminent writers and artists to name the writers they thought were the most overrated and underrated of the century. And Barbara Pym's name came up twice as the most underrated. Suddenly, she was the flavor of the month. There's stories about her. The books all come back into print. They can't wait to publish her next book. She's a bestseller. It's a wonderful, it's the kind of rediscovery story every writer wishes could happen.
And it had to be just wonderful for her. I mean,
it was great.
Well, I wanted to mention, we couldn't go away without talking about Helen Gurley Brown, because for her, food, I mean, she did not eat. She had very precise eating habits.
She was the craziest of the food people in this book. In terms of, she was, as you know, a fabulously successful businesswoman, and she engineered one of the greatest publishing feats in the history of magazines in America when she turned around Cosmopolitan. It was this kind of limping along as a nothing magazine, and she took over, and 5 minutes later, it's one of the most successful women's magazines of all time. So she had plenty of brains going for her, but when it came to food, she was really kind of nuts, and she was deeply committed to an image of herself as young, skinny, and sexy, and she held on to that image from the age of 40 till she died at 90, and she wouldn't let it go. So that meant plastic surgery, it meant wigs, and it meant fanatic dieting, such that her favorite thing to eat was a box. She would take a box of diet Jell-O. you would make it with one quarter of the amount of water that you're supposed to use. Well, the result of that is that you get this kind of red brick of chemical sweetening. And she would eat this every day and twice on weekends. And she describes it as heaven, yeah, which is a fascinating choice of words. She had a huge sweet tooth, and the closest she would allow herself to come to sweets was this peculiar, rubbery, chemical, red thing. It was a really strange relationship with food.
Yeah, and with her husband. I mean, she worked hard to get her husband.
Yes, and marrying David Brown, who was a successful movie producer, that was like the crowning glory of her life, and she talked about it all the time. Only, you know, it was, and she bragged about what a happy, wonderful marriage they had. And that was she used herself as the image of success, so that when she was editing Cosmopolitan, she put herself forward as the person, you too can be like this. Don't eat very much. Get the plastic surgery. Wear the wigs, and you will win a husband like David Brown, and you're going to be happy the way I am. And she put this forward all the time. Well, I don't know, but they never ate together unless they were going out. If they were home in the evening, she would make some kind of meal for him. Towards his later years, it was lean cuisine. It was a diet frozen meal and a diet milkshake, and he would have that at sort of dinner time. And then late at night, she would have one of these blocks of Jell-O and maybe a little tuna fish salad for herself. It was, you know, it was not the kind of cozy meal between loving spouses that we like to think of as a happy marriage. So who knows what was behind all that?
Yeah, who knows? And here she's someone who, would she write a 400-page cookbook?
Yes, on top of all this, she wrote a cookbook. Her publisher decided that since she had this huge, successful public image as this, you know, cute, sexy, funny, successful woman, she should turn out a cookbook and fill it with all the little innuendos that made her prose in Cosmopolitan so successful. And, you know, people like cookbooks, and this would be another successful thing she could do. It didn't really work out that way. She had somebody else create the recipes, and then she rewrote them in her own voice, and it just was not convincing. This is not a woman you're going to take a cooking lesson from. I think people just sort of saw that. So Sex and the Single Girl was a huge seller, but the cookbook, not so much.
Well, I tell you, Laura, here we are out of time, and we haven't gotten... I really wish we'd had time to talk about Dorothy Wordsworth, but there's plenty to talk about or to read about in your book that we haven't discussed today, and I really enjoyed it, reading it so much. Thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciated our talk.
Thanks very much for having me.
Laura Shapiro is the author of the book What She Ate, 6 Remarkable Women, The Food That Tells Their Story. It's a fascinating read, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it and read it. The lots there to chew on, let's put it that way. Well, coming up, we're going to switch gears a little bit, talk with another author, though, Michael Perry, our best-selling author, and he's now a playwright. So we'll be talking with him about his latest book and the play that you'll have a chance to see very soon. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.